You're about to listen to a Second City Works presentation, brought to you in partnership with WGN Radio. Subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming platform or listen on WGNradio.com. And be sure to share.
The Second City is a world-famous comedy theater, and it got so famous because it has produced generation after generation of comedy superstars. That didn't happen by magic. Second City's improvisational pedagogy fuels great performance, and the same practices that have made stars of everyone from Bill Murray to Tina Fey can be applied for success offstage, at work, at home, and in the world. I'm Kelly Leonard, Vice President of Creative Strategy, Innovation, and Business Development at the Second City. This podcast is about collaborative conversations, discovering connections, and building a better future. This is Getting the Yes And.
My guest today on the podcast is Ha Jun Chang, who is a professor of economics at SOAS University of London. His books include Economics, The User's Guide, Bad Samaritans, and 23 Things They Don't Tell You About Capitalism, which was an international bestseller. And his new book is called Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World. I think you're going to enjoy this podcast.
Days can't be counted by the money spent. Today was just another better left unsaid. Days can't be counted by the time to rent. Tomorrow's just another like the one that comes next. The car on the highway that leads to the job. At the desk by the boss with the elegant watch. The tick of the clock and the tick of the clock mark the moments till the ticking stops.
Ha Jun Chang, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
This is such a unique book in that each chapter uses a specific food to illustrate an economic principle. And before we talk about why and how you came to write this book, I want our audience to get a specific idea of how this conceit kind of actually works.
Yeah.
In chapter 13, you talk about chili, and you illustrate this through a meal you had in London with your friend Duncan Green. Can you start us off by talking about that dinner and how that leads to a discussion of the economics of caregiving?
Yeah. You know, the world is kind of divided into two spheres at in terms of chili eating. So there's what I call the chili belt, starting with Mexico, where the fruit originates, and going across mainly hot zones at West Africa, South India, and the Southeast Asia, Sichuan in Chile, South Korea, my native country, is a bit of an odd one out there because it's pretty far up north, but it uses quite a lot of chili. Now, restaurants are serving foods from those the regions in countries where chili is not part of the normal diet. Need to be careful with that, how they serve their customers, because some people really cannot take chili. So that spontaneously, these restaurants have evolved this system of chili the denotation, if you like. So there are dishes with no chili next to it, one chili, two chilies, maybe three chilies. So that people in Britain, the parts of the US, Europe, they are used to it. Now, one day I took my British friend, Duncan Green, to Sichuan restaurant in London. And this restaurant, to Duncan's shock, had up to five chilies in their system. So he got scared by looking at the menu. But I told him, look, you are in this place, which is serving food famous for using tons of chilies. You know, you have to try them. So I told him, okay, I'm not going to order anything with five chilies. Let's try some things with three, maybe four chilies. And he kind of grunted and agreed. But in the last minute, he said, can I take an insurance? Can I order one dish without any chili? So I said, yeah, go ahead. If you cannot handle the rest, you can at least eat that. And yeah, when the dishes are delivered, I mean, there's this tiny plate of some vegetable dish, which is what he ordered, but had six pinky-sized chilies spread across the dish. And Duncan freaked out and called the waitress and said, look, there must be a mistake. I ordered no chili dish, and this has six chilies. The waitress looked at it and said, oh, no, it's the right dish. And he said, how come? But the menu said that it doesn't have any chili. And then the waitress said, oh, you know, the chilies in the menu, they are just indication of how hot they are. It doesn't necessarily mean that there's no chili, even if there's no chili next to the dish's name, because there's no dish in the Sichuan food which has no chili. Mm-hmm. Duncan had to fish out the chilies. Still has some problem with those. This has the happy ending, because still liked the food, even though he found them too hot. And then he kept going back to the restaurant. Now he's very good at eating the spicy hot food. So, there's a happy ending to that story. But yeah, this illustrates when something is ubiquitous, we take it for granted. Mm-hmm. And when we take something for granted, we don't even count it. So in economics, the best example of that is unpaid household work and care work that is done in families and communities, mostly by women. You know, this the work is actually quite substantial. You know, depending on how you estimate it, people come up with figures like 30% of GDP, 40% of GDP, but it's not included in the GDP, you know, because the GDP counts only things that are transacted in the market. So, you know, do a little thought experiment. Two mothers swap their kids, and then they pay each other for the babysitting service. And suddenly they are adding to the GDP, right? Or even better, that they can raise their respective wages by 10 times, you know, and that they'll add hugely to GDP, but their financial situations are the same, you know. So that we have this absurd situation where this care work, which is, I mean, without which we cannot survive.
No, there is no civilization.
Exactly.
Without,
yeah, there's
care.
No economy without
no economy.
Care work, but
yeah.
We don't even count it. This is partly because of the sexist bias, but it's also because that in the current way of thinking about economics, we do not count things that are not transacted in the market. Yeah? And we saw that also during the pandemic that even paid care work is poorly paid. Yeah?
Right.
So that during the pandemic, the U.S. government designated people like medical doctors and nurses and the people working at old people's home as the essential employees. In Britain, they were called key workers. Mm-hmm. And we call them heroes. We said that thank you to them. But then the people then realized that almost everyone in the category, except for top medical doctors, are actually poorly paid. So this is because in the market is $1, one vote, not one person, one vote. And therefore, okay. I mean, even if it's something that people desperately need, like, the protective equipment for the medical staff, you know, more care workers in the old people's home, these were not provided. And literally millions of people died because of that. Whereas some billionaires were having their own space race, you know, shooting rockets. And yeah, so we have at one level said that, you know, the nurses, the teachers, you know, the people working in the old people's home, they are essential. And then the essential people are being paid badly, but non-essential things like shooting rockets getting a lot of resources. So this shows that if we leave everything to the market to be decided in terms of their values, so if we let the market decide the value of everything, then we are actually getting the balance wrong in the society, because there are essential things like the care work, paid or unpaid, and a bit more broadly, what the economists call reproductive labor, you know, that the people say growing food, selling food, delivering food, you know, the firefighters, you know, the people that do maintenance work on infrastructure, you know, the society cannot reproduce itself without these people. But these people are, according to the logic of the market, very poorly paid, whereas people who are doing, you know, the less essential things, that let's face it, like university professors like myself and, you know, investment bankers, I mean, the society can survive without them. Yeah.
It's interesting, because I two thoughts sort of both reading this and then talking now. One is this problem is just going to get worse, because in terms of the aging populations, you're going to have those people who needing to care for children and for parents at the same time. And you have this gray tsunami happening, as the guy with the gray hair is saying. And then the other thing is, and we have done a lot of work in the caregiving space with our friends at a group called Caring Cross Generations here in the States. And part of what they're doing is sort of saying, you know, our storytelling has been bad around this. And this is exactly what you are doing, which is the thing I appreciate about this book, which is people tend to, when you hear economics, there is a wide swath of humanity that is just going to sort of wash over and not necessarily be interested. But when you place this inside a story, and in particular, you recognizing for a lot of us, you, me and others, which is like, I love food. I love the story of food. I love, you know, I love our fiascos with food. You talk about this as well. And I think that's why the chili thing is so funny, but also poignant, because it is. And it's funny, you say in this thing, when you talk about the Scoville scale about the hottest. The hotness of chili is not really a taste, but a pain.
That's right.
I love that, because it's like, yeah. And for some people, that's our experience. But also underneath, when you talk about it, there's like, no, this is a real issue that we ignore at our peril. And I feel like that is kind of a line through almost every story inside the book.
Yeah, I mean, that's really great that you are seeing this book in that way, because that's exactly what I wanted. You know, I mean, I am of the view that democracy is meaningless in the capitalist society unless everyone knows some economics. You know, because so many things in our lives almost everything is bound up in the monetary consideration, in the economic, in the language of economic efficiency, and so on. So, you know, I mean, it's not just our jobs and pensions and inflation rate, but, you know, things like, you know, I mean, you have the monetary consideration is there, even if you are talking about the teaching of ancient languages in universities, you know, funding of museum. You know, in Britain, I very frequently come across people who try to defend the monarchy in terms of the tourist revenue that it generates. You know, what a demeaning way of justifying an institution that they believe to be at the foundation of their society. I mean, maybe I can say that because I'm an anti-monarchist. You know? Maybe I can say that, I am against the monarchy, but at least it brings money in. But if you're a monarchist, you know, is that something that you cannot and shouldn't justify in terms of the monetary value? So it's come to that. So in that kind of society, if people don't know economics, you know, what are they voting for? You know, I still remember in 2000 U.S. election, a lot of Americans voted for George W. Bush, who now looks like an elder statesman thanks to a certain the later president,
a certain orange character who ended up as president of this country.
A lot of people voting for George W. Bush are saying that he looks like someone I could have a beer with, on that account, I can be the president of the USA. I'm
happy. I'd have a beer with you if you want to be president.
What a way to elect someone to the most powerful office, political office in the world, So I really believe that we need to fight against this economic illiteracy. But, admittedly, for me, economics is very often dry, boring, And I understand why people don't necessarily want to read about it. So this is my trick, I give them food stories, and before they know it, I morph it into an economic story.
Yeah, you do.
So in a way, my food stories are a bit like the ice cream that some of your mothers might have offered when she was trying to encourage you to eat your greens, It's a bribe, But my bribe is better than your mom's bribe, because in my book, the ice cream comes first and greens come later. So if you don't like to eat the greens, you can't just read the food stories and be done with it. Although I think
that's hopefully not what people are doing. I want to talk too, because I first visited the UK in the mid-80s with a traveling soccer team, football team. I distinctly remember landing in London, and I think what we called every restaurant we went to was McBlandy McBlandalots, because it was so bland. And the same with Scotland soon after when we were there. I'm like, and of course that has changed completely, but this was very similar to you, because you landed also in Cambridge in the 80s, right? And you're coming
1986.
Korea, tell us a little bit about your food culture, and then coming into this,
Korean food is at the time when I was growing up in Korea, we actually had very few kind of restaurants serving foreign food other than the Japanese and Chinese. I mean, there were a few heavily Americanized French restaurants, and a few kind of Italian restaurants, and quite a few restaurants are serving what we used to call light Western, which is basically Japanized European food, like schnitzels that are made with pork, which is in the Japanese tonkatsu, other kind of pale imitations of European food. So I had very little experience with different foods, but at least the things that were sold were tasty. We had a lot of garlic, chili, exciting ingredients. So when I came to England, I couldn't believe how bad food could taste. Everything was at roasted until they are dry and too tough to eat. And, there were vegetables that by the looks of it, one's carrot, the other's spinach. But when you taste them, they taste the same, because they're both boiled to death and seasoned only with a little bit of salt. And my nightmare was that there was this pizza restaurant chain that, well, now gone, thankfully, called Pizza Land, which gave its customers an option to have their pizzas topped with a baked potato. They were worried that the customers would be traumatized by foreign food like pizza.
So cheese and tomato sauce is going to throw them off.
Oh, absolutely. So it was a complete nightmare. But interestingly, now it's completely different. I mean, you can... anything, the Korean food, Polish food, Turkish food, you name it. I mean, the other day I was passing by a food court in London, and they were selling Uzbek dumplings. I didn't know that Uzbekistan, that people in Uzbekistan eat dumplings,
That's actually fairly remarkable. If you think about this, that is a fairly short time to go from, I mean, really, truly awful system to being what I would say is probably a world-class food city, top 20 in terms of that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So my theory is that sometime in the late 1990s, the British people had an epiphany, collective epiphany.
This has to change.
Decided that their food sucks, yeah. And once they did that, it opened the unlimited horizon, because once you give up your own food, you know, why should you prefer Mexican over Korean or prefer Indian over Italian, you know?
If we could only figure out what happened in the 90s to spur that, we might be able to change much bigger things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So I don't know what that is. All right. So let's dig into some of these chapters. I was really interested in the okra chapter, and I have to say, all right, Chicagoan who I helped run an initiative for 4 years at the University of Chicago. Mm-mm. This podcast, I think, is in many ways set up to smear the name of Milton Friedman every single time we can have an opportunity to do so. I mean, Second City back in the day had like funny songs about Milton Friedman, and I think because our starts were at the University of Chicago, so of course that is a figure who looms large. But let's start with okra being something that was brought to the U.S. and the rest of the Americas by enslaved Africans. And I actually didn't know that the term came from Igbo in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So that was interesting to me.
Yeah, and also the gumbo is from an African language. Yeah. So, you know, the gumbo is, I think it's one of those Bantu languages that, I mean, an African word for the okra. So, yeah, I mean, the enslaved Africans brought the things like okra from Africa. And, yeah, I mean, without those enslaved Americans, I mean, the U.S. would not have become a major economic superpower. First of all, they initially provided, you know, the free labor the price not for the providers
unpaid labor
they provided unpaid labor to the southern landowners, and throughout the 19th century the two main slave crops, the cotton and tobacco, accounted for at least one third of U.S. export, and in the 1830s, they accounted for over two thirds of the U.S. export. Which means that without those crops, the U.S. would not have been able to import all those machines and technologies from then the more advanced European countries, which would have slowed down the U.S. economic progress enormously. And also the slaves provided the capital as well, in the sense that, you know, in those days the land was quite cheap in the U.S. because it was plentiful. Mm-hmm. It was labor which was in short supply, and therefore a lot of loans were made by using slaves rather than land as collateral. And then those loans were packaged into what we these days call asset-backed securities, and sold to financial investors from Britain and other European countries. You know? And to the capital, the U.S. Became geographically what it is today only because of enslaved Africans, although these were not those Africans in the U.S. These were the slaves from in Haiti, which then was called Saint-Domingue, a French colony. And they had the revolt against the French the colonizers and expelled them. And that put Napoleon, the ruler of France, off his American positions. So when James Monroe, the later president, but at the time State Secretary under Thomas Jefferson went to Paris to buy the port of New Orleans and a bit of hinterland. He was offered the whole thing, you know, the French possession in North America, which was then called Louisiana, which basically is at the middle third of what is United States today, because Napoleon decided that he was disengaging from North America. And yeah, this was a time when there was no email, you know, not even telegraph. So apparently Monroe was holed up with the American ambassador to France for a couple of days agonizing over whether he should buy the whole thing. And he indeed decided to do that, which is now called the Louisiana Purchase. And when Monroe came back to the U.S., apparently Jefferson flew into a rage, saying, "You idiot, I told you to buy the port, not the whole thing. Yeah? Mm-hmm. Why did you buy this useless land?" Yeah? But the irony is that later this useless land, so-called, turned out to be the breadbasket of the United States. And then even for the Europe, because in the late 19th century, they started exporting the wheat to European market. And then also this Louisiana Purchase gave the U.S. The springboard to reach the Pacific, because later they bought the northern half of what was on the west of Louisiana from the British in Oregon Purchase, and took the southern half of it from the Mexicans after they beat the Mexicans in the war in the late 19th century. So yeah, there we go. I mean, without that slave revolt in Haiti, the U.S. would have been, you know, three separate countries, yeah, English right. speaking in the east, French speaking in the middle, yeah, the part Mexico, the part Canada, in the west, yeah, they would be the global superpower called the United States of America. It would have been a pretty big and prosperous country, but you know, nothing like what you have today.
Yeah. So what's so interesting is we had my dear friend Dolly Chugg on the program from the NY Stern School of Business, and her book A More Just Future is about, you know, she loves this country. Her she's an immigrant. Her parents were immigrants to this land. And part of the idea of loving your country is also being honest about where you come from and where this country was. And so this particular story just sort of points out that, you know, this idea of unpaid labor, creating social capital, the grabbing of land. We haven't even talked about wiping out the indigenous Indians.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
So that's that. But, and this unpaid labor thing continues beyond those particular slaves from Africa and Haiti and elsewhere into, you know, Chinese Americans in terms of building the railroad. All of this is our origin story. And it's not, and, you know, and this is the, I think this is the fight that exists, a big fight that exists in our country today is those politicians and the people who follow them who just don't want to admit it.
That's right.
And in so doing, like, I get it. I understand why that feels bad. But if you don't understand where you come from, you have no way of going into the future in a way that can be successful for you or anyone else. I mean, it's sort of like that idea of like, if the thing's broken and you refuse to look at like how it got broken, it will just continue to be broken.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I mean, the first part of my book is called Overcoming Prejudices. Mm-hmm. And there are so many kind of racial stereotypes, cultural stereotypes, I mean, that myth about your own history, you know, myth about that your relationship with other people, you know, all of these need to be looked at and acknowledge. Yeah?
And are you a British citizen now, Ajahn?
No, no, I'm past no. That. Still a Korean citizen. Yeah.
But you live in Britain. You live in the UK, right?
Yeah, yeah. No, I've lived in Britain for 37 years. Although at the moment I'm speaking from Korea. Yeah.
Okay, it's fun. So one of my favorite podcasts I listen to is a two World War II buffs. One's a historian, one's a comic. It's called We Have Ways of Making You Talk, and I've been listening to it from the very first episode, which happened right before the COVID hit, and I'm working my way through. And one of the things that's so fascinating to hear a British perspective of World War II, because, you know, in America, you don't think about the fact that this empire, like the Navy, right? I mean, this is, in terms of modern history, there was nothing like that. So when you talk about the Lyme in later chapters, it's very much that of like, okay, this is how this was so important to Britain then extending this unbelievable reach that
doesn't
even exist today.
That's right. Yeah. So the chapter on Lyme starts with the scurvy.
Yeah.
I mean that humans cannot actually synthesize vitamin C, unlike most other mammals. So that we have to ingest it, and we can store vitamin C for at least 1 month, sometimes 3 months. But beyond that, if you do not keep taking vitamin C in some form, you develop scurvy, which is this horrible disease that would swell your gums and joints, and your teeth will fall off, and you die. And so that in the very early days, this was not a problem because most people didn't travel very far,
right.
But when these long distant sea voyages that developed after the 15th century, this became a major problem because if you are sailing on the sea for 1 month, 2 months, maybe a couple of years even, then a lot of sailors will die of scurvy. So apparently in the 18th century, it was customary to assume that half the sailors will die on any longer distance voyage. Yeah?
And that's the cost of doing business at that point.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Yeah. But the first country to have solved this problem was Britain, because by the kind of trial and error, a lot of people figured out that citrus fruit is effective in preventing scurvy, although they didn't know that it was vitamin C that was doing that work. I mean, that was scientifically established only in the early 20th century. But scurvy was so important in the finding of vitamin C that its scientific name is anti-scorbic acid.
Wow.
Yeah, the anti-scurvy acid, So the success of Britain was with the way that they made the sailors take the vitamin C, because what they did was to mix the lemon juice initially, but then quickly the lime juice because it was so much cheaper. Lime juice into the ration of rum given to the sailor. Yeah?
Perfect.
So, it's a bit like my book. You give it with alcohol, they'll drink it. Yeah.
Okay,
I give economics with whose story people will swallow it. Yeah. They made this change and almost immediately wiped out the scurvy, which other sailors are still suffering, and that was a very important reason for British naval dominance. Yeah? So much so that in America, a lot of people called Brits the Limeys. Yeah.
Oh, I actually never put that together.
Oh yeah. It comes from that. Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So it was initially termed for British sailors. Yeah.
Yeah,
eating lime all the time, but now it's the general comfort of British people now.
And then the economic idea in this chapter too is that we have a lot of limes right now that could help people that we are not, that ain't happening. So,
exactly,
so
yeah.
that maybe if, you know, 500, you know, if half of our fleet is going to be gone, and maybe this is actually interesting with COVID, right, in terms of what we did and what we didn't do, but everything from driving cars,
yeah,
you know, what we eat and what we put in our bodies, you know, all of that. And this is about market incentives and again, about free markets and this idea that just because we say it's free, sort of indicates to a lot of people that it means good. And
exactly,
it's like, well, that's not always the case. And it's also not always the case that free means free.
Yeah. Yeah. So the economic story in the Lime chapter is about climate change. You know, the thing is that a lot of people think that if you give enough kind of price signals in the market, people will come up with alternative energy technologies and change their consumption behavior and so on. But, you know, this is not going to happen, yeah? Because you need an organized way of making this happen in the same way that a lot of other countries also knew about lime or lemon in the terms of preventing scurvy, but they didn't organize themselves into doing it. Yeah? So, for example, if you just tell I mean, consumers that, you know, that saving energy is good for your purse, you know, because we are going to give you the price incentive. You know, people might do that, but then this is a very complex interrelated system. You know, if you want to change people's behavior, you actually need a real investment. You know, a lot of Europeans find it easy to feel virtuous against the Americans because they, you know, say, I cycle 12 miles each way every day to go to work and come back home. Look at those Americans driving around like mad. But I tell them, okay, I mean, if it's 12 miles you can probably cycle, but what if it's 120 miles, you know?
I was at a concert last night in a suburb of Chicago, and the artist was like, how many people took public transportation? And no one said anything. And I literally yelled out, because we're in the suburbs. I mean, and then people yelled, we all walked, which was literally half of the people. I'm like, yeah, it's different in terms of how just massive this sort of country is.
Exactly. Yeah. So if you want to change people's driving behavior and so on in the US, you need to reorganize the living space, you know. If you want to change the way we do agriculture, we need to, you know, find different ways of feeding people and introduce different kinds of culinary traditions that rely more heavily on vegetarian things, you know. So that all of these changes that we need for fighting climate change from, you know, the developing alternative energy technologies, that reorganizing the living space, that introducing the viable public transport system in areas where there's none. You know, all of these need organization, and that story about the British Navy and the supply of lime is really an interesting example of how, you know, simply because how it is wrong to believe that simply because there's something available, people will do it. You know?
I didn't see this in the book, and I might have missed it. So, but I'm curious what your opinion is around something like choice architecture. So that also comes out of primarily the University of Chicago. Richard Thaler wrote the book with Cass Sunstein. And so do you think that that is an element that could be in play, or are you part of the group that there's a little bit of a backlash happening on that right now?
I think it's, something that could be useful under certain circumstances, but I think the problem is that so many of our problems need more fundamental changes in the social relations, ownership structure,
And, that it's not, person by person is not going to do it.
That's right. Power balance. Okay. So, you know, I'm not totally against it. You know, there are some things that you can do to, you know, as the term goes, notch people into, you know, a better decision. But so many of our problems are not going to be solved by that kind of thing. You know,
it's and funny. You... Go ahead.
Sorry. No. Yeah, and also this idea that you know these individual choices can bring big changes hinges on the assumption that individuals have actually time to process all the information given to them. Yeah?
So, time, power, access.
Exactly. Yeah. Things. Yeah. So ideally, you know if you believed in individual choices, ideally you would provide them with all the information about, I don't know, a packet of potato chips that you buy, or a packet of, serving of fast food that people buy. But who has the time to read all the labels, you know, think about what they eat? And
right.
You know, we don't have that kind of processing power, you know?
No, and I think about this just in my own, you know, we're empty nesters now, and the fact is, when you're young parents and you've got more than one kid, you know, I'd like throwing some chicken nuggets that you're heating up or whatever is like kind of what you have to do in terms of just making it through to get to bedtime so that you can, you make it through the next day. And that's now, true. Of course, as we're getting older, my wife and I we eat fish. We pack our lunches. We're so much better about it. But cognitively, we freed up space. Physically, we have more space. We have more time. Absolutely. Our jobs allow us different. Yeah. And that is just, I mean, that, you know, that didn't occur for the bulk of that period. So
exactly. Yeah, that's right. So the kind of informed choices that we ideally like everyone to make, that's a pipe dream for the majority of people. You know, either they are too knackered with their work or the childcare, you know, they don't have money, they are stressed out, you know, they don't have the right amount of information, they don't have the kind of political power to say no to the certain kind of the social structure, you know. So I think that all this the emphasis on individual choices are all very well, but that there are very few people who can actually meaningfully make that kind of choices because they don't have the resources and the mental space and time.
Yeah. I wish we had the rest of the day to talk. We don't. But I want to encourage people to buy this book because if you read the chapter on Rye, you're going to learn that Otto von Bismarck started the first welfare state. That's good. And then if you shop a Banana Republic, you will be ashamed of yourself when you read the section on bananas. Hajun, we always end the podcast asking our guests for a yes and story. Do you have one for us?
Yes. I guess that mine has to be when one of my teachers in the graduate school in Cambridge asked me to apply for this job that came up in my field. And yeah, at that time, I hadn't even finished my PhD, and I thought I was not qualified. And then, yeah, my teacher also said, yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a long shot that you still haven't finished your PhD. And yeah, but you know, as luck would have it, one candidate I don't know who it was, but who apparently was better qualified than I, for some reason didn't turn up for the interview. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I got the job, you know, I mean, especially at the time I had grown up in Korea where you are supposed to be modest and humble all the time. And, you know, I at the time thought that it would be actually quite, immodest even to apply for the job. But somehow I did, and yeah, that's how I ended up teaching in Cambridge for 32 years until I moved to London last year.
I don't know that we've had a yes and, which is potentially a breach of etiquette, but I love it because it is, sometimes it is about like, you look, I know it's maybe not supposed to happen this way, but what if we take that chance?
That's right, yeah.
You know, what if we take that leap? The book is called Edible Economics, A Hungry Economist Explains the World. Ha-Jun Chang, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you so much.
Getting the Yes And is produced by Second City Works and WGN Radio. Our editor is Ben Anderson from WGN, and we get support at the Second City from Colleen Fahey, Mike Farinaccio, and Emma Smith. The music you hear at the beginning and end of the show is by Jukebox the Ghost. For more information about the Second City, you can go to www.secondcity.com, or you can email us directly at works@secondcity.com.
Survive.